Buddhist Geeks. Seriously Buddhist, seriously geeky.
Episode 73, The Darker Side of Zen, Institutions Defining Reality. The Zen institution has a darker side that has to do with ways in which the institution itself grants legitimacy and authority to its leaders. While the practice of Zen is extremely valuable, many of us aren't aware of the ways that the establishment itself defines reality for us. This is part two of a two-part series.
Looking at political ideas often is very fruitful when you're trying to look at religious stuff, that there's a kind of mirroring back and forth in some way if you change terminology in that. But reading Chomsky, Noam Chomsky, a political commentator and linguist, he uses a term called useful doctrinal fabrications. And I think that's kind of, it's rampant in the religious stuff. So one of the things that we have to look at is this mythology of the, what is the Zen model, their standard model, right? Which I think is a useful doctrinal fabrication. But anyway, the story is that Buddha Shakyamuni was talking to this large assembly, and at one point he holds up a flower, and Mahakasyapa was one of the 500 or 1,000 people in the assembly. Only he smiles. And the Buddha recognizes that he understands this, what later came to be called the silent teaching. And so he passes his lineage to Mahakasyapa, and he talks about it, mentions something about having the true Dharma eye, et cetera, et cetera. And then that mythology is that Mahakasyapa transmits to Ananda, the Buddha's nephew, and so on through 28 Indian generations. And then it goes to China with Bodhidharma, and then there's six Chinese patriarchs. So in this scheme that was created, it's one master per generation. And then after the sixth patriarch, Weinang, in China, it becomes a multilinear branch and spreads all over China and goes to Korea and Japan. This is a total fabrication, though. It actually, the model really started to be developed in China in the 7th and 8th century, when genealogy was really important to the literati and the elites of China.
I see.
So that was an idea, and one of the things, and it took, even at that, it still took another few hundred years, probably till the 10th century, before the how many generations you really needed to get that much time, and there were many, big holes in this thing. And
right.
The whole thing is just really constructed.
Right.
And if some of the early stuff in China, they were just stealing lineages from each other, with seeing what seemed to work, right? What was a good story? How do we connect this guy with that guy? The Indian lineage is pretty much just made up. At one point, they were only like, 10 or 12 generations to get from the Buddha to China, and then they realized, well, that's not enough people, right? They had to start filling it in.
And they'd have to be living pretty long lives.
everyone really was healthy and lived a long life. So it's important, and that's just a doctrinal foundation of fabrication. But it's kind of like the key and the base of the legitimacy of the Zen master and his authority, right?
Right.
So now some people start to say, well, so they don't really pay attention to it, although it's repeated over and over and over. And I did a survey once, and a number of people wrote to me just exactly that. That, this is the last in the lineage for 2,500 years, going back to Shakyamuni Buddha. And someone else wrote, I saw in a book recently, how their teacher was the 78th in the lineage from Shakyamuni Buddha. On and on like that. So it is believed, you know.
Right.
And it's a strong mythologizing story, but it's really what Chomsky calls a useful doctrinal fabrication.
Right.
But the key in this thing is that there's this Dharma transmission ceremony, and that should not be, that really has to be paid attention to, because it really does have dramatic effects, right? So it changes people's understanding of the transmitted person, right? So now the transmitted person is made to be the representative for the institution. He has to be directed, spoken to as Roshi so-and-so or Zen Master so-and-so. He has this honorific title.
Mm-hmm.
People have seen him publicly made to be the representative of the institution, along with this whole belief in lineage and having the Buddha mind, because that's the story, that the Buddha mind is what's transmitted. Other sects of Buddhism in China base themselves on different texts. Zen said, no, we are the heart or the mind of the Buddha, right? So this is a big public ceremony where the older master is saying, this is the new person that embodies that and becomes the spokesman for the institution and speaks for Zen now. It also changes the transmitted person, because now all of a sudden people are addressing him differently and bowing to him, and he has a new role. So he kind of feels obliged in a way to adopt that role and to play that role. So there's a whole powerful thing that takes place with this public ceremony of Dharma transmission. One of the key aspects, I think, of this, one of the really important things is that once this happens, the person that's transmitted, he talks for the institution.
Mm-hmm.
He represents the institution. He's the delegate of the institution. And his words carry all that weight. You know, words and roles and institutional roles have weight. And so it carries all of that authority and legitimacy of being the transmitted person who has the Buddha mind in this 2,500 years of unbroken lineage, right?
Right.
But that, at the same time, condemns everyone else to only having personal opinions. So there's an enormous imbalance set up now. So when Joe Schmo says something, well, he's really only given his personal opinion. But when Roshi so-and-so talks, he has institutional authority. He has legitimacy. He has a whole history backing him up as the delegate and spokesman for all of Zen. So it's a very strong imbalance that takes place.
Right.
And to see how this stuff gets repeated, If we go back and look at the, you know, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, I like to go to that book. I think Suzuki's talks in it are terrific. I think Baker's introduction is another story. In that introduction, he says, what the teacher really offers the student is living proof that all this talk of the Zen master and the seemingly impossible goals of Zen can be realized in this lifetime.
Hmm.
Well, essentially he's saying that the Roshi or the Zen master is this perfected being.
Right.
There's no half Zen masters. There's no like, well, he's pretty okay. That's not what he's saying. So he's directing people, this is how you see the Zen master. That Zen can totally be realized fully in this lifetime, because here's Roshi Joe in front of you. So when you put all of this together, right, all these endless stories, the koans, the rituals, the bowing, And there's so much stuff that gets embodied in chanting, in going to interviews, addressing the person, these kind of writings, the talks of these senior students, on and on, that's how this thing is transmitted. That's why it has so much power. Even I know if there's a book, Shoes Outside the Door, which I've used a lot about the Dick Baker and the San Francisco Zen Center.
Mm-hmm.
And in there you get a real good picture how powerful this stuff is. Even in some, there's a few episodes in there where new students look at Baker and they see, hey, this is crazy behavior, you know, this is nothing, right? Because they haven't been fully indoctrinated yet. They're still new, so they can still see things a little. So they go to older students. I think in one case, one guy goes to Reb Anderson, who is like, you know, really begging Baker to give him Dharma transmission, right? And he said, Jesus, Reb, Baker seems like, you know, he's off the walls with all of this stuff. And I think he says something like, well, you're not enlightened. You don't understand. You don't understand. Baker is Dharma transmitted from Suzuki Roshi.
Mm-hmm.
So you just can't understand what he's doing because you're not enlightened yet. And it essentially becomes a sign of saying something, becomes a sign of your immaturity in practice. And it's presented as though there's something negative about you. Jesus, you know, you really didn't advance enough to see what looks like craziness to you is really enlightened behavior. And that's what he's told by the old, by essentially the second oldest student there, or the second most powerful student there.
So really there have been, I mean, I've certainly, having read a couple of these books and reading your paper, there have been several episodes with plenty of Zen teachers in America where, yes, sexual misconduct was happening, financial misconduct's happening, interpersonal misconduct. I mean, all sorts of breaches of ethical
alcoholism,
behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, we don't have to get so far into the specifics because it's pretty clear that stuff's happening. But, I mean, and it's pretty clear that what's enabling it is what you were talking about earlier, which is, mm-hmm, these ideals that get communicated and adopted through these structures and these stories. Noam Chomsky's notion of the, can't remember what it's called, the
useful doctrinal fabrications.
The UDF.
That's right.
And so I'm wondering if you could share what you think the fallout of, for people and for the teachers themselves, is when these ideals are adopted and then they don't hold up or the community comes tumbling down. What's the fallout for people, including, you know, including the teachers themselves?
Okay. Well, sometimes the fallout, if there's a real scandal, right, that's generally very painful, right?
Right.
And so some people leave Zen permanently. They just don't want to do it anymore. It's, you know, that bubble's been shattered. And I think that's really unfortunate because I think, I mean, I've seen as much of this as probably most people. I wouldn't say others haven't seen more screwy stuff than I have. But I still think the practice, the core practice, the core teaching, what's there, is worthwhile pursuing.
Right,
and
right.
Staying with. But, you know, if you really, some people, it's just too shattering when this bubble gets burst, that they put so much into the teacher and the Zen master and that, they leave. They leave permanently.
Mm-hmm.
They don't leave permanently. They go to someone else or they look for another group, but they just don't trust the teacher again, right? I knew a woman like that really got pretty beat up by Shimano. I mean, not physically, but, you know, psychologically, emotionally, because, mm-hmm, whatever. And she stayed away from Zen for a number of years, and then she knew that I liked this Chinese group, and she started going, but she was just really gun-shy to accept it, someone as a teacher.
Right,
so that's
right.
Another, some people, you know, people write to me, because after some stuff happens, they're looking on the internet for stuff, and one of the things they find my papers.
Right.
So I've heard a lot of stories. There was one woman that extremely bright, successful business lady, right? And her husband's an academic, so it's a, you know, it's a kind of an intellectually bright family. They're both very high achievers, and she was involved with some guy, and she saw how crazy it was, and then decided to leave. And he would tell her that he was, that she was breaking all the faith and trust he had in her. And he kept spinning this stuff that she was leaving because of all this, you know, him carrying on with students and causing strife between couples and, you know, et cetera, stuff like that, and repeatedly doing it over years. And he would be able to fool her, and she'd send me his letters, and I'd say, look, don't you see what he's saying? He's flipping the table on it. He's done da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then he's saying, you really disappointed me. You don't trust me. And I had so much faith in you. I thought you were going to be a leader here and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she was so, you know, this is an extremely bright, verbal woman, couldn't read what was going on. We used to go over it time after time after time. So it's so, what I'm trying to say is, you can't imagine how powerful this stuff is.
Right, the habitus that you
mentioned. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that, you know, one thing that I've come to realize, and you can, I just always say it to myself and to other people, you can't emphasize enough the power that institutions have to define reality.
Mm.
Once you buy into one of these situations, that is so strong. I don't understand how it happens and how it works, but it's there. And if you underestimate that, you're going to be wrong every time. It defines reality. They have that power. I don't know why, but they do. And people seem to almost be programmed to accept authority figures.
Right. It seems like there's something that's kind of invisible about institutional or cultural power that it's hard to see. I mean, unless you say, like you did, you actually witnessed it, but even then, it sounds like it took a lot of the academic study and really seeing some alternative perspectives on the whole thing and really being able to, spending a good amount of time piecing this thing together to really see the structure and how it was affecting people. So it's not something that's easy.
That's 100% true. And the reason it's not easy, because their legitimating stories seem flawless. You have to, you know, you remember, they're developed over hundreds of years. They've been refined. So they see what works. And then it's made to seem natural. It's made to look like it's gravity. You know, when the apple falls from the tree, no one goes, hey, how did that happen?
Right.
You know, of course. Of course you bow to the Zen master. Of course the Zen master is this fully enlightened being, because he's the last in this lineage of unbroken Dharma-transmitted people going back 2,500 years, or this woman who I just looked at the introduction to her book and how affected she was that her teacher, now she became his Dharma heir, that my teacher was 78th in the lineage.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That was, how much more legitimacy can you need in all this 2,500 years of unbroken history of mind-to-mind transmission, the mind of the Buddha, that ordinary and regular people just can't understand. It's beyond their grasp and ken. It's just such a strong, legitimating story. And then when you mix it with that it's relatively new here, and you have Asian people coming over, and they have, you know, the robes and all the paraphernalia, and then you know, the practice itself is powerful. You know, meditation is a very powerful thing, and is, you know, and it's a valuable tool. and then doing the ceremonies and the bows and the incense and the chanting and all this. So the whole thing becomes some kind of seamless web that's embodied, that becomes into our body with the all the physical aspects to it, not only mental and like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so this whole, and then there's all this literature and these endless stories that are all really charming and enigmatic, and they seem to have profundity, on and on like that. So it comes from every side, that it's in the body, it's in the mind, it's in the practice, it's in the story, it's emotional. And then in the end, I think people come to adore the master they create. So it's very hard to, it's a very powerful story.
Yeah, yeah.
And on top of which, if you go to question it and leave it, look what you're leaving. You're leaving the thing that makes life meaningful, makes sense. You're leaving a teacher. You're leaving a social context, a place in a social setting. You're leaving, it's very common if someone leaves a group, their friendships in that group disappear very quickly.
Right.
They're losing a place in a social context, right? So you know, well, you're not all new students, you're up in here, and then there's the Roshi, and then there's older students, and I'm maybe fourth level older student, but there's still five and six, or you know, whatever the social setting is. How, so you have a whole, your whole world is ordered around this and made meaningful and sensible around this. It's not easy to leave.